Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. When the Oregon State Legislature goes into special session this summer to address new COVID-19 policies, medical and public health professionals from across the state are calling on Governor Kate Brown and Oregon lawmakers to include fire and smoke preparedness measures in any legislation that addresses the impacts of COVID-19. These health professionals point to the mounting scientific evidence that exposure to fine particulate matter found in wood smoke and other air pollution can significantly increase the risk of mortality among those afflicted with COVID-19. Today we talk with Catherine Thomason with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about the preventative measures that healthcare leaders are urging state officials to enact. Catherine, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's about time to start talking about smoke, as a lot of us, now that it's the middle of June and we have memories of the last few summers, last summer being a wonderful exception, where smoke is the big story of the summer. So I was very interested when I got the press release from Physicians for Social Responsibility about your concerns about smoke and COVID. So there's a whole lot of issues we can cover today. But let's first of all talk about why the Physicians for Social Responsibility is so concerned about the health impacts of the smoke that we're expecting this summer from who knows how many wildfires we have.
Well, smoke produces particulate matter, and it harms everybody, really, when it's dense enough. You know, smoke, as we know, if you've been around a campfire, you know that it's irritating to your eyes and it hurts your throat and can make you hoarse. But if you have asthma, if you have heart disease, if you have any other kinds of lung disease, you're more at risk from the very small particulates that are most harmful to your respiratory and cardiac health. So it can cause asthma exacerbations. It can actually cause heart attack and cardiac irregularity. So it's not healthy to breathe in a lot of particulate matter.
Now, this has been a concern for quite a while now. I think going back to about 2015 is the first year that I remember having a lot of smoke in Portland during the summer during wildfires. And I think those fires were coming down from Washington that year. Of course, in 2017, we experienced a real intense smoke when Eagle Creek started burning. And it wasn't just smoke. I remember going out on my deck at night during the second night of the fire, and I thought it was snowing out because it was all the ash that was landing in my backyard. So it's becoming sort of a regular seasonal expectation every summer that there's going to be these wildfires, whether it's the 600 that were in British Columbia in 2018 or all the fires that burn from Southern Oregon or from California. How has this changed the public health concerns about smoke, since it's not just an occasional thing that happens now, but it's we now have fire season in Portland like we never had before?
Right. Well, it's something that people need to know about, and they need to know what they can do to protect their health. What kinds of precautions to take, because they haven't had to worry about that before. So because it's more frequent, and it's more frequent because right now we're Oregon, almost all parts of Oregon are in drought. And in the south, southern part of Oregon, as well as other parts of the west, they're in something called a mega drought, which is kind of it's happened four times in the last 1,000 years. I mean, it's a very rare experience that makes the conditions very ripe for more fires. Because when things are all dried out, that's the best wood to burn when you have a fire, right? So the climate, it reduces the humidity, it reduces the humidity of the soils, and we're just more at risk. And that the mega droughts have happened before, but now we're having more fires regularly because of climate change. Our summers are hotter, they're drier, especially in the east side and the southern reaches of Oregon. But to be honest, they're still less frequent than they were 100 years ago. And part of that is because we don't have as many forests as we did before. We've cut an awful lot of them to make way for farms and homes and building materials and so on. But it's become apparent to everybody that fire is a hazard and that we have to prepare for it.
I think it's an interesting thing to people who live in the northwest corner of Oregon, because it appears like it's pretty wet. I started hiking again on Mount Hood a couple weeks ago, and it was really wet up there, and there's a lot of snowpack, and even Mount St. Helens has a lot of snow. So we're looking at this and going, oh, it's a normal summer. You know, we've had a lot of snow, and so there'll be a lot of moisture in the soils. However, when I talked to people in southern Oregon, I was talking to a woman from the Klamath Tribes a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about how serious the water situation is there. And they're afraid of having, from the tribal perspective, a lot more water wars with the white farmers down in Klamath County. The other thing interesting to me, I am kind of a weather geek, and so I check the climate data almost every day from the Weather Service, and I noticed that we're like about a 7-inch rain deficit for the year already from the water year, which starts in October. So even though it appears to be moist now here in the mid-June, it's not at all. I wonder how we get people to understand, when the ground might be muddy, that that's not meaning that we're not going to have a serious fire problem this summer.
Right. Well, we have different ecosystems in Oregon, as you mentioned, the west side of the Cascades is wetter, just naturally. But still here, we're at deficit. So all those wonderful sunny days in February and March and even January, we don't remember now when we get a little bit more rain. So it's good to look at the data and understand that it's natural as well for the west side forest to be in drought during the summer. Doug fir, the biggest tree species in our forests on the west side, is designed to tolerate summer drought. That's what we have often, and that's why we like our summers here, because we don't get a lot of rain then. So the second factor I think that people forget is that the mountains usually receive a fair amount of their precipitation as snow. And when we have hotter springs, that snow melts faster. And so the soils dry out faster because it doesn't have that protection of snow still present in the forest and on the soils. So that's the second factor, is that that snowpack melts quicker. And that definitely affects our water quantity as we go through the summer.
Well, another thing that's a big concern this summer, which has never been a concern for any of us before, is the impact that all this smoke might have on both people who are prone to get COVID-19 and people who actually have it. And why is the smoke so much of a danger in the midst of this pandemic?
Well, there's a study that was done out of Harvard School of Public Health that looked at county data and tracked it with actual deaths from COVID. And they tried to control for various variables, because we know that, you know, you and I over 60 are more likely to get COVID or die from COVID, that actually obese people are more likely to die of COVID. So they controlled for a lot of those factors, and they still found an 8% increase in COVID deaths from the levels of particulates, particularly the small particulates. So there's the ability to fight off this infection and not die of it can be impacted by the particulates that we have. So in this pandemic, we just need to be even more careful.
Let's talk a bit about these particles. Now, I think people are becoming more familiar with PM 2.5, which is the very, very tiny particles that are in car exhaust, among other things, and a lot of other kinds of pollution. How does that compare with the kind of particulates that are in smoke? And why is smoke so dangerous to our lungs in particular, and maybe to the rest of our bodies?
Part of it is just concentration. So when you have a wildfire, as you saw the ash on your back deck, there's just more of it in the air. The particulates that come from our vehicles actually come from a chemical reaction in the air that produces these particulates. And those are the ones that harm us long term, because we're exposed to them, especially if we live by the freeway or next to a coal-burning power plant. That is a constant low-level chronic issue, whereas a wildfire is an intense high particulate event That's why we'd see the moon in that rosy haze in 2017, because it's so dense that it's more of a harm to us because of the concentration.
I'm actually having this memory of it was the Multnomah Falls fire back, I think, in 91. And I was driving up to Mount Hood with my puppy, and suddenly we hit a place between Boring and Sandy where the smoke just started pouring in, and the sun turned into the moon. It was an amazing thing, and my dog freaked out totally. That was a really good example to me of just how thick that the smoke was and how much of a filter it was for something as bright as the sun. Yeah, what does that say about what it's doing to us?
It's going to trigger more problems because the concentration is high. And that's why we want people to take precautions. And we should take those precautions as well when we have a, you know, high ozone day or a high air pollutant day from other factors. People with asthma are told, stay indoors, don't exercise outside, keep your windows closed, so that you are protecting yourself from this air pollution that is outside. Sometimes that's enough. You know, if the event goes away, if the event stays day after day after day, it's kind of hard to do that. So we have to protect people even inside their homes. So, you know, in the summer, a lot of people don't have air conditioning in anywhere in Oregon because we didn't used to need it very much. So it's kind of hard to keep the windows shut. So that's kind of a secondary issue, and why we certainly could use the idea about smoke shelters, just like we've been talking about heat shelters. So for the homeless, for people who don't have air conditioning, who are at risk, who can't keep their windows closed, is there a safe place that we can bring them? And those are, you know, we're calling them smoke shelters now. But the same would be true for retirement homes, making sure that their air quality is adequate and that they have air conditioning in those spaces, which frankly, most of them do at this point. So it gets into what's our indoor air quality and are we able to improve it?
It seems like a certain amount of contradiction that we're facing being in the midst of this pandemic where it's safe to be in your house. It's safe to be outside as long as you're social distanced outside. It's not safe to be in a large or even our small public space, period, with a lot of other people for very long periods of time. So I wonder, how can we protect vulnerable populations who don't have air conditioning, who aren't going to be able to stay safely in their house with air conditioning during a heavy smoke event? How do we protect them in these smoke shelters that you're describing?
Well, I think they're beginning to learn more about masks and how masks can be helpful. The use of air filters that are in some of our fancy vacuum cleaners, they're called HEPA or HEPA filters, and they stand for high efficiency particulate air filters. Other kinds of materials that are something they call electrostatic, which, you know, frankly, I hadn't even thought about that characteristic of being able to trap those particles in the mask and not let them get into our lungs, or to trap the viral particles coming out of our mouths to infect other people and trapping them in the mask. So it goes both ways. Initially, we were told that these cotton masks were effective for protecting other people against our spit, basically, as we talk, we project both sound as well as water particles, and they can carry the virus. So the cotton mask can protect other people from if we're carrying the virus and shedding it. But now the masks can be made even for those of us who aren't getting a very high protective device. We can purchase those and we can get those. And I think with social distancing inside, without, you know, singing together, again, that projecting of air pollutants or air water particles is something that we just need to be conscious of. So it's a matter of which is worse, and it's gonna be something that we just need to take great care with.
Or you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Catherine Thomason with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about preventative measures that healthcare leaders are urging state officials to enact in order to mitigate COVID-19 deaths from wildfires this summer. Well, let's start running down your whole checklist of things, because they sound very familiar to the things that I've heard from fire ecologists who've been dealing with trying to get the public and particularly elected officials to understand what real fire protection means. So there's the concerns we have in faraway places from the woods, like Portland, where we're sort of far away, to places that are in what they call the rural, the wildland-urban interface, which is like close to Ashland as an example. So what are some of the thoughts that you have about what people need to know and ways that the elected officials and local officials can really help to protect people in this coming fire season?
Well, I think that we have this issue of smoke. And I just want to tag one more thing onto our previous conversation, is that what can people do in their homes when they have the windows closed and they have air conditioning? Are air filters helpful? I think a good website is the National Jewish Health Organization that has a section on smoke. And there are filters that can be as inexpensive as $90 and as expensive as $1,000 that can purify the air in a room or an entire household. There's certainly filters that we can put on our furnaces if we have a furnace that blows air throughout the house. Again, that HEPA filter is key, and it has to be a graded true HEPA filter that does remove these particles down to 0.3 microns. The best ones are usually 2 or 3 stage, so they last longer. So they're going to take the dog dander, and they're going to take the other dust particles from just general dust out of the air. You know, you can then wash that part of the filter and then let the HEPA filter do its job at removing the very tiny particulates. So there was a program in Ashland that they applied for a grant from the Department of Environmental Quality to provide those in-home filters for people at high risk who couldn't afford them for themselves. These kinds of filters for high-risk people, people with asthma, who are on medications, heart disease, etc., could and should be thinking about, well, maybe I should buy a specific room filter for $90 and put it in my bedroom so that when I sleep at night, it's purifying the air, even though we're in a wildfire smoke event. So I wanted to throw that back in there, because that's also something that's really useful for people to know.
It's interesting. This is a discussion my partner and I have been having for several months. We have a friend who's an acupuncturist, and she's been really promoting air filters. So we've been going back and forth about whether we really need to get an air filter. So is it something that you think is necessary for everybody, or just for people who are high risk because of respiratory conditions?
I would think that it would be high risk for respiratory conditions or cardiac disease. For $90, saves a trip. How much does any, emergency room visit cost, right? Or heart attack.
But for people who are basically healthy, do you think it would help them in wildfire situations to also have an air filter?
I do. I actually do. So those of us, can I quantify that risk? No. I'm a young 62-year-old who's very healthy. I'm now technically at risk of COVID and being more likely to die just because of my age. And I haven't bought an air filter. So I think it depends on your sense of concern. It certainly is going to be less costly to buy it now than when we're in a wildfire. So that's certainly a consideration.
That'll be another thing. There'll be a run on air filters along with the toilet paper run and the Kleenex boxes and stuff like that. Let's talk about some of the other concerns that you have about people's safety and how to protect, how to be proactive, because we're really possibly only a month away from beginnings of a lot of smoke. Actually, let's back up a little bit and talk about this letter that PSR sent to the governor and the state legislature. This is about a month ago, right? Why did you send that letter, and what was in it?
Well, we sent that letter outlining everything we've already talked about. We were concerned given the pandemic and given the drought, severe drought that Oregon is having, and the entire West, because, you know, the smoke doesn't stop at the state border, that people need to be warned and they need to have extra awareness about these risks and to take precautions for themselves, including the air filters ahead of time. So that was a part of the reason that we sent the letter. The other is that, you know, the governor created a wildfire task force a year and a half ago, and that has offered a whole suite of concepts around how do we protect ourselves, or in fact, it's really how do we prevent the wildfire in the first place. And preventing wildfires, you know, we don't manage the weather. You know, we're just not that powerful yet. And so more wildfires occur because of the climate than they do because of fuels. But there's a concept out there, well, if we just thin the forests out and we reduce these fuels, then we will prevent wildfires. And so that's something that we'll kind of get to. But that costs in so much money. And it's, again, it's that prevention. Prevention is useful when it's cost effective, when you can take the actions easily. But it's not something that, you know, we can't thin all the forests in Oregon. It just wouldn't happen properly. And in some circumstances, and this is what where we get at the paradox, if you take trees and thin the forest, you're taking carbon stores out of the forest and you're allowing them to go into the atmosphere to worsen climate change. And so at some point you have to ask, what's better ultimately for climate change? Is it keeping our forests intact? Or is it doing this heavy thinning, or, well, let's just cut them all down, you know, just log incessantly and then we wouldn't have wildfires. Well, we all want forests to still be there. So those are that's the balancing act that comes in with thinking about landscape level changes that people want to think about doing to prevent wildfires. And so so what are we trying to do to prevent wildfire? Well, people die if their home burns up, if they're caught in the home, right? And we saw that with Paradise. And that's so scary. That is so scary. People in rural areas who are at what's called the wildland-urban interface are truly concerned and scared, and they should be. And that gets down to, well, what's the best way to help protect that? Well, the first is to think about, well, what can you do to protect your home? And then what can you do to protect the area around your home? And so it's thinking about it from the home out and not from the forest in. And that's kind of the other component of the letter that we sent.
Well, actually, to me, it goes back to a problem that we do not have nearly as badly in Oregon as it exists around the rest of the West. And that is, we have a much smaller wildland-urban interface. I mean, it's really in a few pockets in southern Oregon and also around Sisters and the Bend area. But because of our land use laws, there's way little sprawl into the woods than there is in California or Washington or the Mountain West. We've done a good job there. Of course, there's always the need to encourage people, I guess, in my opinion, not to build in the woods in certain places where you're going to be reliant on social services like fire trucks coming in, you know, from great distances and at great expense. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing is, if you are in the woods, then to do things that are going to protect you. But before we get to that, I'm just curious about, has PSR taken any positions about encouraging people not to build deeply into the woods or in canyons or all these famous places that burn throughout California?
I'm not sure that we have a specific policy that supports our current land use laws, but I can imagine that they would all be for it. Yeah, it kind of makes sense.
Well, I was visiting a woman outside of Missoula a few years ago, had this beautiful cabin. It was a log cabin she built in the woods. And she was burning brush when I got up there. And I made some comment about, are you clearing the area? the safety zone. And they sort of were, but they sort of weren't. And I started talking about the dangers, and she was kind of like, and she's a very strong environmentalist, and she's kind of like, I really don't want to think about it. So how do we get people to, yes, you have to think about this?
Well, that's where the public education campaign is really necessary. And there's actually some simple retrofits on homes. Some of the homes burn because the embers actually can enter their home through a vent. Can you imagine? Your home wouldn't have burned if the fire didn't actually enter it. It's kind of like keeping the door open in the face of a flood. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So there's vents that can be covered that only vent when there's a positive airflow that should frankly be part of building codes in these areas. There are, you know, fire resistant materials. You know, you're not, who would put wood shingles on a home in the forest that might burn?
Lots of people. That looks so cool. You feel like you're part of the woods.
Right, right. Well, you know, the typical shingles or even metal are naturally fire resistant. Same with siding and things like that. So doing those kinds of common sense things on your home, gutter guards, right? You know, so that you don't have a bunch of needles and woody debris in your gutters when a fire sweeps through. Those are all something they call home hardening or protecting the home from igniting. And studies show that this works really well. I was really deeply disappointed that when these bills were being heard in the short session, that from the push back from home builders and other interested parties, they took all of those new building codes out of there, which made no sense to me. But obviously, when you get something from on high, you have to pull these people in to say, well, what makes sense here? What can, you know, are there certain circumstances where these should be required? And I think we will revisit this issue again in the next session. And then the other part that you started saying, well, are you burning brush within the 60 to 100 foot area around your home, which is the what's called defensible space or home ignition zone? So if the fire stays 100 feet away and you have a resistant roof and your vents are closed, the home's not going to ignite. Keeping wood piles away from the house, removing brush or small trees close to the house. And these are done in areas like Deschutes County. They do a really good job of educating people there. But that's not being done uniformly in these wild urban interface locations where wildfire is likely.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Catherine Thomason with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about preventative measures that healthcare leaders are urging state officials to enact in order to mitigate COVID-19 deaths from wildfires this summer. Well, we had that rather abortive session, short session with the state legislature back in February. Were you hoping that some of these fire protection bills would actually move forward in the session and become law?
Well, I felt like they did need to have a lot more work, and we were working very hard to try and prioritize where thinning would occur. And, you know, does it make sense to thin at the edges of bend? Well, yeah. Does it make sense to thin around, the areas directly adjacent to communities? Yes, because that will help protect them. Does it make sense to pick an area that isn't near a community and thin there? Well, it's less than 1% chance that that particular area over the next 10 or 20 years is even going to burn. So, and by in 10 years, all that underbrush is regrown anyway. So it's prioritization, especially when you have a constrained budget, which we always do, but even more so now, is important to look at. And thinning isn't without problems as well. So thinning combined with, especially on east side forests, combined with controlled burns is are both necessary. The thinning to help protect and keep the controlled burn constrained, I think, is part of that. And the controlled burns help do it naturally without having lots of machinery on the ground that compacts the soil and makes it, you know, hold less moisture. More roads allow fires to get through faster. So there's lots of components to thinning that aren't necessarily healthy for the forest or and worsen climate change. It's complicated, frankly.
It also seems that there are significant cases where they call it thinning, but they're really logging. And sometimes it's close to clear cutting, and they're taking out some pretty big trees. I know that they were doing that down around Cave Junction in what became the Biscuit Burn area. So is there any concern that you're raising about what, how to redefine thinning? So thinning really means taking out small flammable trees and not taking out 30-year-old Doug firs that are on their way to becoming mature?
Absolutely. And that those were some of the things we were advocating for, that there be a, that they're called non-commercial logging. Usually commercial logging requires the size of the tree to be a certain diameter, limiting them to 21 inches or less, or even preferably a lot lower than that. Because the older trees are the most fire resistant, and we want those trees to stay there. The older trees absorb more carbon because they're just bigger. You know, they're adding these rings over a larger area. So if you talk about the rate of CO2 absorption in a tiny sapling, well, the rate may be higher, but the total volume is less. So you want these big trees. There was a study I just read where 1% of the trees, the largest trees, are the ones holding the most carbon. So we got to keep these big trees. It's really, it's good for the forest. It's good for climate change. It's good for our soul when we walk through the forest to see these big trees. So that's real important.
Well, there was a story that came out on Oregon Public Broadcasting, the Oregonian and ProPublica, which is a really incredible expose of private timber lands and how they've actually been transformed. They're no longer considered timber lands. I think they're now basically real estate, and they are being taxed differently. Basically, they're not being taxed. And so it's a couple things that they have really loose logging laws. And it turns out that Oregon has much looser regulations on logging on private lands than either Washington or California does. So that's a question for our legislature to ask. And the other part of it is that these companies are going in, and because they've changed their corporate status, they're not paying nearly as much taxes to these local communities. One that they were focusing on was Fall City, that's just west of Salem. And so these small towns and counties are losing what used to be all this revenue from logging. So these small communities are kind of falling apart too. The thing that I was concerned about the most was that their logging practices that they're using is that they are now cutting trees that are 40 years old. Trees that should have been left at least to 80 years, which would have been like the old commercial cycle, are now being cut at 40 years because they make more money. They're not allowing the forest to reestablish itself in a healthy way. And they're also really exacerbating carbon emissions. So I'm wondering, in the work that you're doing, are you dealing at all with private lands? Are you basically looking at public lands?
We have to look at private lands too, and people don't understand one of the statements that you just made, where Weyerhaeuser is not a family-owned logging company or forest land holder. It is now a real estate investment trust, and it's the majority owned by foreign owners. And so they don't see trees, and they certainly don't see forests. They only see dollar signs. And the faster rotations where for the first 11 years after a clear cut and a broad spraying of pesticides, which damages people's health who live nearby, doesn't sequester any significant carbon at all for 11 years. And then they're going to cut the trees down in 30 years. So, you know, they're beginning to sequester at that point in time. So looking at all of those and saying to ourselves as policy people, as people who want our water sources for small towns and even Salem, you know, not to have algae blooms, Our rivers need water, and when you do a clear cut with evaporation, you lose both quality and quantity of water. So for all these things in watersheds, clear cuts are bad. Are there private timberlands in Oregon that are being managed in a different way? Absolutely. They selectively log. The benefits of selective logging, keeping a multi-story forest intact, is that a multi-story, multi-species forest is much more fire resistant. It employs more people because you can't take one person on one machine and log a whole acres and acres in a day, put them on a truck and send them to the mill. You're actually going to create more jobs in the forest doing that kind of selective logging. And if we enact through what Portland put forth and said, we will only purchase certified sustainable logged materials in our building codes, you get a better dollar for that log that tree that you've just cut down, and you've not super harmed the entire forest ecosystem by clear cutting. So you get all these other benefits from what we call climate smart logging.
Well, I want to get back to COVID because that was sort of the heading for what this letter was proposing and what the show is about. Why are you bringing these things up at the time when the legislature is coming back next week when they reconvene for a short session?
Doing public education and putting out information, having people share this recording or share your website material with others, that's part of public education. And it doesn't necessarily need a lot of funding. So it's pretty cost effective to educate people on how to protect themselves. So that's very, very important. Whether or not people have access or are thinking about smoke shelters is a bigger issue. And so having some funding go to that makes sense, because that's also going to be, you know, the heat shelter for the same group of low-income individuals who could die of heat exposure in Southern Oregon or Eastern Oregon and are homeless. So it covers multiple threats at the same time.
So what other proposals are you making besides the heat shelters, air filters, and changing our logging practices and having people harden their home against fires? Are there other issues as well where people could make some changes?
Again, the broadest brushstrokes are climate change. And we are so very happy that the governor gave us this executive order on climate. And the agencies, in almost every set of comments that we've put together so far, expedite is so important. So we have to broaden and move quicker to deal with climate change. And climate change is exacerbating pandemics. So it's all tied together.
So what specifics were in Kate Brown's executive order?
Well, she identified 17 agencies and commissions that had to put a climate lens on all their policies and budgets. Wow, that's pretty big. Now, we'd still like to see them do that in the education department, because we need a climate lens everywhere. One big program is to say, okay, we need to look at all the different major sources of climate emissions and put a cap on them and begin to reduce them over time. So that is being spearheaded by the DEQ, and that's a big issue.
How well is the DEQ going to do on that? Because they've been falling down a lot lately. So what kind of pressure are you putting on the DEQ to actually activate this mandate?
The spotlight's on them, you know. So we have to keep the spotlight on all the agencies. The Department of Land Conservation and Development that creates our urban boundary, growth boundary, they have had the authority for the last 10 years to do exactly what they're now being told to do in the executive order, that they have the authority to help counties and municipalities to look at their transportation, to look at their population density, to improve the ability for mass transit or walking and biking, which is healthier for us all. So the authority had been previously there in that particular instance, and have the Oregon Health Authority to say, okay, well, what do we need to do to help people prepare? So it's really a big mandate. We've identified some things that can only be managed by legislation, so we'll need to move ahead on those issues too. But this is a great first start, and all the groups that are working on this, and there are many, including, you know, the Democratic Party of Oregon, are creating comments. And we, you know, anybody who wants to work on this, find a group to work with and keep the spotlight on the agencies and keep their feet to the fire.
So if you send me a link that people can connect with in order to take action, then I'll put that on the Locus Focus website. So we should have that on. So I just want to get back a little bit to the COVID connection, because we sort of start there and we keep going off these other things. Why is this so important now in terms of the fact that we're facing this, or we're living through this pandemic?
People are dying. We're in Oregon. We have been successful at bringing down the curve, but it's beginning to go up again. So the concern is that once people get COVID, that the wildfire smoke will make them sicker, or increase their likelihood of dying. So it's a very serious public health issue, that we have to protect ourselves from a lot of air pollutants, that create, particulates. We should get rid of our gas stoves because it creates particulates in the home at levels that are regulated outside of the home. And no great majority of health professionals don't know about that. So we have to protect our lungs if we do get COVID, so that our bodies can fight this off the best way possible and quickly.
Well, speaking of gas stoves, next week I'm going to do a special show about the dangers of methane. So it's a nice segue into that. I want to let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Catherine Thomason with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about preventative measures that healthcare leaders are urging state officials to enact in order to mitigate COVID-19 deaths from wildfires this summer. This morning, I got an email from Timothy Inglesby, who's been on this show a number of times, and he's a firefighter, and he formed an organization called FUSI, which is a bunch of environmentally, ecologically minded firefighters who've been fighting, besides fighting fires, also fighting for better regulation and better protection of the forests that they're trying to keep from burning, or they're actually hoping some of them will, that the state will let them burn a little bit more. So I wanted to read you the email because he was very happy that we're doing this show today. So he said that he hopes, in addition to discussing the increased risk and severity of COVID-19 that citizens will face from smoke emissions or crowded evacuation centers, you and your guests will discuss the increased risk to safety and health that wildland firefighters will face. He goes on to say that the agencies, the United States Forest Service, BLM, Oregon Department of Forestry, have resurrected the obsolete policy of aggressively attacking all wildfires in places in order to limit wildfire smoke. However, there is a reason that this fire policy from the 1930s was abandoned. It is ecologically harmful, economically unsustainable, and puts firefighters at unnecessary extra risk. The risks of aggressive suppression are inherent, but now the risk of the pandemic add new dangers to crews. However, no one in power is addressing these risks adequately. Firefighters are simply deemed essential workers and expendable. An internal study by the USFF's scientists has determined that a worst-case scenario, there could be a mortality rate of up to 10% of wildland firefighters this summer. At 14,000 firefighters lost in federal agencies, do the math. This could be a horrendous casualty rate of young people on the fire lines. The number of COVID-19 victims is predicted will surpass all other causes of firefighter fatalities. And for each person who gets diagnosed with the illness, it could force mandatory quarantine on the rest of their 20-person crew. There could be major pandemic disasters sweeping through fire camps, ultimately leaving rural residents on their own. So he wants us to raise that issue. So is that something that PSR is thinking about? And is that anything that was included in your letter to the state legislature and to the governor?
Yeah, actually, it was not. One of my good friends, her son is actually a firefighter. And she went to visit him up in Washington, actually, where he's with his crew doing training. I'm wondering whether these crews shouldn't be quarantined from outsiders. to keep the COVID from coming in and infecting this crew that is fighting shoulder to shoulder, and necessarily shoulder to shoulder, in those very intense, scary, and frankly, dangerous, just in and of themselves to fight fires. So that's another reason why protecting our health from the smoke and allowing some of the fires to burn, when typically about 5%, so on average, a forest fire only destroys about 5% of the total volume of trees in the area. A lot of the smoke that you see is actually water vapor. So allowing more of these fires, particularly when, you know, we've had a recent rain or, you know, some other mitigating factor that would reduce the risk of having it become catastrophic, like a biscuit fire, does make sense. So having a better policy around that in terms of, yes, we're going to stomp on fires immediately around a community to protect the community from damage. But again, prioritizing just the same way we talked about before.
Well, actually, with the biscuit fire, they let it burn for a while, which is part of the problem in retrospect. And I talked to several people, including Timothy, who were saying that you don't let a fire burn on July 19th is when it started, in the middle of an intense drought, that was not a good judgment call. And we are, again, going to be in the middle of an intense drought. So I just wonder how you weigh these different things. I know my experience living in Portland, there's been a number of fires on Mount Hood since I've lived here, and I don't remember the smoke coming from any of them into Portland. But we have gotten smoke from BC when there were 600 fires burning in BC. So I wonder about how much of it has to do with the intensity of the fires, because the fires that burned on Mount Hood were actually good fires. I mean, they should have burned. And I've spent a lot of time in some of these burns in the last 8 years since the fires happened. And the forest is growing back beautifully. And it also, there's one trail in particular, the Vista Ridge Trail, which I started bothering me like in the 10 years before the fire. I couldn't see the vistas anymore because the trees, it was so overgrown. So after the burns, like, you can see all those incredible vistas, and that's why it's called the Vista Ridge Trail.
It's complex. I think it needs to have experts, forest experts. It needs to have public health experts to come up with some criteria and not pounce on every fire. And that's, you know, that's beyond the scope of, you know, the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, because it's not our scope. So we hope that Tim and others who are specialists and knowledgeable about making those judgment calls and allowing some of the fires to burn that are going to improve forest health in the long run, while accepting. And actually, this brings up another point, and that is the governor actually put a, she didn't require it, but she basically said people who are applying for local burns, like your friend burning brush, to try and not do that during the COVID time, right? Well, you know, a lot of fires are caused by humans. So we should, you know, ban campfires. You know, we should ban a lot of these others, but not allowing some of the controlled burns that will reduce the severity of burns in the future is not a good trade-off. So I think that we should be prioritizing those kinds of burns and keeping other kinds of personal, you know, there's a lot of trash that people shouldn't be burning anyway, and they're harming themselves for doing it, besides brush that go up in smoke. So those other areas are important too.
I'm actually wondering about that. I've been thinking a lot about the burns. I was driving around a while back and saw people burning a lot of stuff. You know, it was like brush burns. And I was a little surprised that they were doing it and wondering if it was even being allowed at that point. I just wonder, is that something that you're addressing and trying to push through the legislature, that they do a ban on basically on inessential burning, which to me is you can leave the brush on your property that you were going to burn. You can have it in a place, maybe wet it down all summer, but just leave it there until it's safe to burn again. And again, thinking about, you know, arson, which is like arson and unintentional arson, like the Eagle Creek fire. And most of the fires, I understand, actually are set by people. And so I'm wondering what kinds of efforts there are to educate people, like that kid who started the Eagle Creek fire, about, yo, you don't throw firecrackers down into a ravine.
Yeah, that's that probably is something that we should look at and discuss with the other experts around this area and bring to the governor's attention.
What's your plans? How far has this letter gotten, and what kind of follow-up are you planning on doing it during the special session next week?
The letter was sent, obviously, to the governor. It was sent to all members of the Wildfire Senate Committee. And they introduced it as formal input into their process. We, as an organization, and there are many organizations that are following these issues, to continue to lobby and call on people to get involved at whatever level of expertise they are that can help influence this. So Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility is one organization. But there's many others that Tim's group of the firefighters is another that I'm glad they're all speaking out, and we need to have people engaged around this issue in the short term around COVID, even though a year doesn't feel like a short term, or 2 years in the grand scheme of things. In the scope of climate change, it's, you know, a shorter term. So weighing those issues is important.
Well, Catherine, it's been good to talk to you, and good luck with this. I hope that this effort bears some fruit, and that we have people in safer conditions when the smoke starts this summer, which I'm sure it's going to start. So thanks for being with us on Lucas Focus today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Today, we've been talking with Catherine Thomason with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And you've been listening to Lucas Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you are able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the Donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Seattle atmospheric chemist Heather Price about the truth about methane. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with Peace Like a River by Paul Simon. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
Changed. You can beat us with wires. You can beat us with chains. You can run out your rules, but you know you can't outrun a history train. I've seen a glorious day. I used